Let's call this meeting of the Local Government Committee to order. The first bill on our agenda for today is House File 2945, Representative Mahoney. Welcome to the committee.
Good to be here, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sterner moves House File 2945 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on State Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. Proceed with your bill, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House File 2945 is a bill that addresses property maintenance codes and rental codes. Back in 2008, May, I think it was, Supreme Court threw out municipal rental codes and property maintenance codes in a decision called Morris versus Sack. What this bill does on line 1.19 changes the statute to say different from and insert in conflict with, which what that does is say that a municipal code or rental code cannot be in conflict with the state building code. It can't be different from. And then on page 2, line 32, it inserts the words property maintenance rental licensing and a provision that says this subdivision prohibits the municipality from, nothing in this subdivision prohibits the municipality from adopting ordinances. So members, what we have is a situation where there is substantial confusion amongst people who have to regulate rental codes and enforce municipal codes. Is there a page?
Page, come forward.
Could you please pass this out to the members? This is a list of cities and counties and their rental units in them. So it's a significant problem for many, many cities and towns. This issue was discussed last year, but we couldn't come to an agreement because between the cities and the opponents of this proposal. The Department of Labor and Industry convened a working group throughout the interim to come to a consensus. Unfortunately, some parties were unwilling to compromise. So I'm moving forward with this legislation to provide certainty for cities and the landlords for the next several years to ensure that renters are protected from health and safety issues and to ensure that the neighborhoods have the means to maintain their property values. This legislation maintains the status quo with some limitation until the Department of Labor and Industry can more fully vet this issue through their building code update process. And just to make you aware, because of our budgetary problems, any change that they make has to go through a rulemaking process and a code adoption and a rulemaking process. The department has told me that the soonest that they would get to making any changes to the building code to adopt rental and maintenance codes would be at least 3 years and could easily run to 6. It depends on how, as they try to bring people together over the interim, over the next few years, to come up with a statewide outline of what a maintenance and rental code could be. So to continue, Morris v. Sacks undermines the ability to enforce housing and housing maintenance requirements for owners owners occupied or rental units. State building code preempts local regulations of building maintenance standards. The state building code is not a maintenance code. Under the state building code, you must wait until a building system or component fails and then take action. Which in other words means that if the rug is torn, you can't require them to change it or fix it in a rental property. The linoleum is torn, you can't tell them to fix it. The paint's peeling off the wall, you can't tell them to fix it. If the window pane is broken, you can't tell them to fix it because it's part of a component, which was one of the main parts of the lawsuit. So examples of health and safety are floor coverings, paint, heating systems, bathroom sinks, I could go on and on, but the one that I'm probably most fearful of, because I do it for a living, is the heating system. When you can't order someone to fix the heating system or inspect the heating system, you can get an awful lot of problems with it. They do, the Supreme Court specifically exempted fire, smoke detectors, and carbon monoxide alarms. And that's a good thing, because if you can't tell someone to fix the heating system or check it, and maybe a cracked heating core, that can have some real serious carbon monoxide problems. I have gotten a number of letters from the inspectors, but even above and beyond anything that I've said here today, inspectors are confused. The state building code did not come into effect until 1972. They're very, very worried if they call someone on anything and they get taken into court, the judge will say, well, when was that building built? And if you said 1945, the judge will say, well, then you have to go along with the building code from 1945. My house was built 100 years ago. I still have the pipes, in half my house for natural gas lighting. Well, that would be what the standard would be for lighting in my home. With that, I have a couple of city inspectors. I have a city inspector from the city of Minneapolis, Henry Reamer, and someone from the League of Cities. So if I could call up my witnesses, Mr. Chair.
Henry Reamer from the city of Minneapolis. You want both at the same time, or?
Grab one of those chairs and pull it over here.
And then is it Tom Grundhofer from the League of Cities? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Henry Reimer. I'm the Director of Inspections in Minneapolis. And if it's all right with you, Tom, I'll kick it off unless you want to start. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the legal situation, the impact of the Morris versus Sachs decision has already been articulated, so I'll just move on to some other points, and if you have questions about what our perspective is on the impact of the Supreme Court's decision, I'll be happy to answer those questions. The legislation that is before you is a compromise solution, and it is a very modest solution to some serious problems created by the Supreme Court decision. And this is a proposal that has been vetted with the Department of Labor and Industry, the agencies in charge of administering state building code, and they find this proposal acceptable. Basically, the impact of the decision is that the state building code preempts local regulation for building maintenance standards. It's already been stated, but it is extremely important to note that the state building code is not a maintenance code. Under the state building code, under the impact of this decision, municipalities must wait until building systems or components fail and then take action. Generally, under the building code, we are not allowed to require preventative action. And I'll give you some specific examples that impacts health and safety, two of our core values, and in ways that we are impacted. One example has been mentioned, the heating system tune-ups and cleanings. Now, if we know that a heating system is malfunctioned, under the building code and under our housing code, we can issue orders to require that malfunctioning system to be fixed. One of the problems with the state building code is, though, that we are not allowed to do anything preventative or proactive to find out whether those heating systems are operating the way they should be. One of the things that we are not allowed to do under the state building code, but we should be allowed to do, is to require periodic inspections, cleanings, and tune-ups of heating systems. Now, this is important for a couple of reasons. The safety issue is preeminent, and I think it should be obvious with some of the instances of malfunctioning heating systems resulting in deaths and near deaths for carbon monoxide poisoning. The other issues are particularly for cities in this housing market, we are seeing a lot of single-family homes being converted from owner occupancy to rental. And what that means is that the owner in charge of the heating system is not generally the same person paying for the utility bills. This isn't the case with multi-unit buildings that generally have a heating system, and a landlord has a financial incentive to make sure that heating system is operating efficiently. When a tenant is paying heat and the rental property owner is in charge of maintaining the heating system, there is a financial incentive to not maintain that heating system to optimal efficiency. This costs money for tenants, and it results in unneeded energy consumption in rental properties. So there's an environmental or energy efficiency component in addition to the safety issue. Another example is the state building code does not require floor coverings. The building code requires a floor. So, for example, in a kitchen with a plywood subfloor and a linoleum top floor, if that linoleum floor, if the hole wears into that floor, under the state building code, we do not have authority to require that linoleum be repaired. That's a health issue where the plywood is a porous surface in an environment in a kitchen where bacteria and other or microorganisms can thrive. Another example, the state building code requires two sinks in a dwelling unit, but does not designate the location of those sinks. So, for example, a rental single-family home could have a utility sink in the basement and a sink in the kitchen, no sink in the bathroom. Under the state building code, we would not be authorized to require that a sink be located in the bathroom. That is a health issue. Another more run-of-the-mill livability issue would be paint. Because windows, siding, and building trim are building systems and components, and the state building code does not require windows, siding, or trim to be painted. If the paint were to start peeling on those surfaces, if the paint deteriorated under the state building code, we would not have the authority to require that paint be repaired. We would have to wait in each of these cases for the situation to deteriorate to such a point that there is structural failure. Once again, we are precluded from being proactive and are confined only to being reactive, which tends to be more expensive, less healthy, less safe, and less livable. Now, when I talk about that paint issue, that's not a health or a safety issue, but it's a livability issue, and it is important as we struggle to maintain livability of our neighborhoods in face of the housing market collapse and the foreclosure crisis. We are on the brink with a lot of neighborhoods in this state, and it's important for us to be able to adequately address exterior building issues before they get to such a point as to being structurally failing. This legislation merely restores some of the municipal authority that existed prior to the court decision. As if you look at it closely, you'll note that it maintains the superiority of the state building code. Municipalities will not be allowed to enact any provisions that conflict with the state building code as a state law, and by express language of that state law, municipalities' maintenance codes would have to be subordinate to the state building code. This is a compromise here. This is a recognition of modest authority on behalf of municipalities. In contrast to some areas, other areas such as North Dakota, where like many other places, Illinois, local amendment to the building code is allowed. They have a state building code, but municipalities are allowed at their sole discretion to amend that building code. We don't have that in Minnesota. We are not seeking that authority by this legislation. This legislation does not give us that authority. This is much more modest authority than municipalities in Illinois or North Dakota enjoy. Furthermore, there's a question as to retroactivity of building code enforcement. And by that I mean, well, first of all, the provisions in the state building code that preclude retroactive enforcement of the building code remain intact and untouched. By that I mean that we are not, under this legislation, allowed to apply 2010 building code standards to a building constructed in 1972. We would have to apply the building code standards in place at the time the building was constructed. That language is untouched by what we are proposing today, and that would continue to be the case. There is no retroactivity in terms of enforcement of building code enforcement. If it were, the Department of Labor and Industry would be here to tell you this is a no-go. They would oppose it if that were the case. Now, it's also, there's another provision of the state building code that remains intact, untouched, recognizes the supremacy of the state building code. Quote, "The state building code is the standard that applies statewide for the construction, reconstruction, alteration, and repair of buildings. The state building code supersedes the building code of any municipality." That's Minnesota Statute Section 326B.121, Subdivision 1. It is not being amended. That law remains intact. So there is no slippery slope. The building code remains a solid backstop from which anything could slide past. In summary, the adoption of this legislation is imperative for Minnesota cities and towns as we fight to preserve our housing stock, as we work in the face of a foreclosure crisis and a housing market collapse, as we deal with unprecedented levels of conversions of single-family homes to rental, and as we work to ensure safe housing for tenants. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reamer. Are there any questions for this witness? Mr. Grundhofer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Grundhofer, General Counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities, and we're here to passage of House File 2945. Mr. Reamer described the situation quite well. I just want to make a couple comments. Since May of 2008, the legal status of a whole variety of local ordinances that affect how buildings are maintained and kept has really been thrown into chaos, and we really need some clarification. The status of the law after Morris v. Sachs is that local governments just don't really know what they can do, frankly. They have a variety of maintenance codes, some have rental housing codes, others have other ordinances that really affect how both residential and commercial buildings are kept and maintained. And Mr. Reamer described the kind of the things that we talked about, painting, maintenance, windows, quality of floors, all that sort of stuff, is really thrown into chaos as a result of the Morris v. Sachs case, because all of those things affect a component of a home or a building or a property. As long as it touches or affects some component of the building or structure, arguably that local ordinance is usurped by this Morris v. Sachs decision. We need to have that corrected. We need to have that clarified. We think House File 2945 does that in a fairly good way. Frankly, it doesn't go as far as cities would like, but for now we realize this is what we are going to have to live with until the Department of Labor District can put more in terms of rules together, kind of deal with this very difficult issue.
Thank you, Mr. Grundhofer. Any questions for the witness? Thank you, gentlemen. Stick around, we may have questions. I've got Todd Liljenquist on the list. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Todd Liljenquist. I represent the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, and we respectfully oppose House Bill 2945. The bill itself seems to be pretty simple. It changes a couple words and adds a couple words in another place, but to us, it does substantially more than that. It effectively undermines the uniformity of the building code. First of all, no one knows exactly what in conflict with means. No one can state with any certainty exactly what a court will interpret in conflict to mean. We know what different from means, different from means that it is the same as. In conflict with, no one can state exactly how that would be interpreted in this context. We believe, contrary to prior testimony, that in conflict with would allow cities to receive the state building code. Properties can currently voluntarily, a property owner can currently voluntarily exceed what the state building code requires and still be in compliance. For example, a property constructed under a code where ground fault interrupters are required near in bathrooms and kitchens, that property owner can install ground fault interrupters for all of their outlets if they so choose. And that would not be in conflict. Well, it seems to me if that's not in conflict with the city, it could require such a property to do that. In addition, a property in compliance with the building code and silent on a particular issue could voluntarily install those as well, the ground fault interrupter example. Property built under a code that did not require ground fault interrupters, the property owner could voluntarily install ground fault interrupters in the kitchens and bathrooms and would not be in conflict with it. Final example, where there's a minimal requirement in the statewide building code that a property owner could exceed that minimum and still not be in conflict with, for example, emergency egress windows. Properties built prior to 1983, the standard was 5.0, at least 5.0 square feet for the emergency egress surface area for that window. Well, a property owner could install a window that is 6.0 square feet installed in conflict with, well, the city, it seems to me, could make that requirement. In discussions with the proponents on many occasions, they've stated that they would like to exceed the state building code. And as you've heard, that is the case. They've stated concerns of what are the property of, well, what is a city to do in relation to cities built under older codes. Well, that implies that they would like to require those properties to exceed the code under which they were built. They've also stated in the advisory committee over the interim that they would like the authority to address issues that the building code under which the property was built is not addressed. So where the building code is silent on a particular issue, they would like the authority to deal with that. And through the building code process, many of those issues are looked at and intentionally unaddressed in those building codes. So the city would like the authority to require those. Cities would like the authority to require those. The uniformity of the state building code is extremely important. It's a position that the legislature has consistently reiterated. Thankfully, from my standpoint, I'm glad that we don't have the North Dakota model and don't allow cities to impose additional requirements. Without a statewide standard, a property could be required to be brought up to the new building code anytime the new building code is adopted. And the legislature, one of the purposes in statute, has said that what the building code does is seek a balance between economic feasibility and safety. And through that building code process, that is the those are the elements that are sought to balance. And so when there is a safety provision that the cities deem important to retrofit, they can go through that state building code process. And they can provide evidence, provide information, provide expert testimony, provide data, and show a statement of need and reasonableness. And that's what's required in that process. And if that group decides that it is an important issue, then they can require that those as retrofit items. Second point, this bill is not needed. The cities, we did hear some information today, but up until today, we have consistently asked for a list of data or information on exactly what we are talking about, and up until now we haven't been presented with that. The only thing that we have heard is some vague generalities about grass cutting, painting windows, broken windows, and those sorts of things. It seems to me that those are outside of what the Supreme Court was touching on. Those are still addressable by the city. There's no statute or case law or rule or anything preventing them from enforcing property maintenance. In your handout, in your materials, the Supreme Court actually stated in there that cities still have the ability to enforce property maintenance. And I already addressed the unsafe conditions cities can make, their unsafe conditions in housing. They can go through the building code process. They also have the dangerous to human life exception in there as well, which the property is deemed to be dangerous to human life. They can address those issues specific to that one property. Finally, the Morris v. Sachs case actually, in our opinion, changed nothing. The court simply read the statute the way the legislature intended it to be. The statewide building code is a standard that no city can exceed, and it served us well for over three decades. if there truly is a lack of clarity on this issue, it seems to me ill-advised to go from a term, a known unknown term different from, to an unknown term in conflict with. And I don't think there's any way around it. That definitely compromises the uniformity of the building code. There's no consensus, even among the cities, as to whether or not there is even an issue. The advisory committee, over the interim, at least one city stated that after the Morris v. Sachs case, nothing has changed, and cities still have the ability to enforce property maintenance. That's at least one city representative has made that comment. Finally, I'll just conclude and say, as I have said, that the Uniform Building Code has served us well, and this would compromise the uniformity of that.
Thank you, sir. And before I ask for questions, just a reminder, we're getting buzzing on the microphones and on the speakers, so if you have your cell phones on, they tend to conflict with the speaker system here, so for the tape in the future, the buzzing is hard when they're trying to transcribe the tape. Any questions for this witness? Okay. What's that? Jeremy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question as much for Representative Mahoney. And I, you know, follow your lead, Mr. Chair, on whether you'd like to represent Mahoney to wait to respond. But I have empathy for the author's position in the cities, a great deal of empathy. But I also am drawn to the position and about the confusion and the sort of moving off of a uniform code to allowing a little bit more of a patchwork. And I'm wondering if Representative Mahoney, I know I'm sure you've thought about this, and I'm wondering if you have a response to that. To that claim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin.
Representative Mahoney.
I'm not sure. I suspect there will be a patchwork. There has been a patchwork for the last 30 years, and that is part of the the rub that a lot of landlords have had. And that's what the hope was of the conversation over the interim to find a list of things that they could do. One of the reasons this bill is coming forward is that they were not able to. I've always been, and I think most people here, particularly those that have been around for 4, 5, 6 years, you know, that I try to strive for consistency or extras in the code area to make the code, the consistency in code. I wanted that this summer. Not going to get it. We didn't get it this summer. Now, unfortunately, because of some of the budget constraints and the time that it's in, next time that they will adopt the state building code is either 2 or 3 years from now. So, and they're not sure. They may be going to a, they may be skipping one of the cycles because of the cost. So that would put it out 4 or 6 years. In that interim, I would hope that some people could come to agreement on what works in Halleck and what works in Winona and what works in Grand Marais and what works in Worthington for a consistent code across city and state and county, city and county lines. So that everyone, if this is a landlord, you know that your floors have got to be have to be totally covered, or if you have peeling paint, it has to be repaired. But if your building has 4-inch wide balusters on the stairway, you don't have to change it to 6-inch balusters. And, you know, so I would love to see consistency. But the department has told me that it is a ways out. So rather than leave the confusion, and that's the fundamental difference we have. They say there is none, I say there is. The building code officials often say there is. I've not run into a city that disagree. I'm trying to find consistency. I don't think I'm going to get it until the Department of Labor and Industry can spend some time going around the state, finding out what works in all four corners and in the center, and come forth with recommendations for the state building code, and then put them into force.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mahoney, I appreciate that very much. I've been thinking a lot about this bill and trying to find whether the positions of, for instance, the realtors and multi-housing folks and the positions of the advocates for the bill are in conflict with each other. And I actually believe that they're not. And so I'm, that what you, the process that you just described, I hope can ripen very quickly. Obviously not in the next 10 or 15 minutes, but I'm, as a somebody with a vote, not only on this committee, but on the next committee it has to go through as well as later, I want to urge the folks who have a stake in this bill to get back to the table and find that, because, again, I don't think they're in conflict with the, I think the concerns can be reconciled and should be, because I find both sides equally compelling and a solution does need to be found.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier, can you help me understand the argument you're making that going from different from to in conflict with changes the uniformity of the building code? I have a hard time understanding how that would be the case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lamb. It's our position that currently properties can voluntary, and the way currently properties can exceed the building code in which the property was built and still be and still not be in conflict with. So a property owner can install an egress window. Say it's a 1983 property. In 1983, they install an egress window of 6.0 square feet. That is above the requirement that the state building code says. The building, state building code says that it has to be at least 5.0 square feet. Well, if the city requires a building code or a egress window to be 6.0 square feet, that is in compliance and not in conflict with what the state building code would require. Similarly, if the building code under which the property was built is silent on an issue, the ground fault interrupter issue in 1970 property, ground fault interrupters were not required. If the city requires those, that would not be in conflict with the property. Just leave it at that.
Representative Lanning.
It seems to me that being different from any provision is essentially the same thing as being in conflict with, and I still am having a hard time understanding how you're perceiving this as a changing of the uniformity. I mean, if it's in conflict, it's not uniform with the building, state building code. If it's different from the building code, it's not uniform. I mean, if there is some provision that's different from or in conflict with, it's not uniform. And so I'm not following your argument here.
Okay.
Mr. Lundquist?
It seems to us that the cities could require things that they currently can't require under the different from standard. The different from standard means that it has to be what the building code states in conflict with, in our reading of it, our interpretation of it. And again, as I said from the outset, no one knows exactly what it would mean. And that's part of the problem. Is going to an unknown standard makes us very nervous to go from the standard that we have known, different from that language that's in there, to go to something that is in conflict with. I think any interpretation of it, any reading of it, could show that it softens the uniformity of it and it compromises. And that's just that's our interpretation of it.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, when it says different from, it means that the city couldn't require linoleum or carpet. Because it's different than what a plywood floor is on a home. And conflict with would say that it would require a, I'm not sure what you use for ceramic tile, but require all of that kind of hardboard for the flooring when you're just putting down carpet or linoleum. That's not in that would be in conflict with, because you're upgrading from plywood, so you're in conflict with. Much in the same that the city could not, I think the egress window, it's changed 4 times in 4 years or something like that, so I don't know the exact size, but let's just say it's 48 square inches, whatever size. The city, and that's what's in the state building code, the city could not require a 72-inch square window because it would be in conflict with. I like to trust the state Supreme Court, but when they put components in, it, kind of threw me off. So when they're dealing with buildings, they're probably not the best place to take it to as a lawyer. It's probably better to take it to someone who writes code. So that's where I'm trying to get this.
Mr. Roten, Representative Lanning?
No.
Okay. Any more questions, Representative Easton?
I think just to take off a little bit on Representative Mahoney's, just about the egress window, I think the issue with the egress window, in that situation, the code always defines a minimum. If you're raising the minimum, then you're in conflict. So, if the minimum is a 5 square foot of glass or something or whatever it is in the window that you have to have, and the city says no, we want to have 6, or we want to have 7, then that's still in compliance with the code, but it's also in conflict with the code, because the code says no, 5 is good enough. If the city says 5 is not good enough, then you're in conflict. So I think that's what if it's different from simply is clear. You couldn't say that. You'd have to have a range. The city would have to enforce the same range as the code. So I think there's a lot of possibilities here where there could be room to upgrade the building code requirements in a way that wouldn't put them out of compliance. Of course, because they're in the range, but it's putting a higher building standard on a homeowner or on a property owner than just the standard building code does. And I think that's kind of the issue that I think is inherent in that language change, that I think it does change the way the building code could be interpreted. So, I have some concerns about that as well. I think that's something I'd like to see looked at a little more seriously, to see if there would be, I don't understand. If they mean the same thing, then why change the words? That's my question to the people that say they mean the same thing. Well, if they mean the same thing, then leave them there. Because they do mean something different, and that's going to give cities, I think, the ability to do some things that they believe that they will be able to do with the new words that they can't do under the old. And I'm a little bit concerned about that, because that the regulatory side of this is that, property owners have some right to be able to, I think, make some determinations about how they want to upgrade their properties as well. And I just think somehow we got to figure out how to do that so that we're not imposing more standard on them than really the law should require.
Next witness was Pam Perry Weaver. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you. Members, my name is Pam Perry Weaver. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association of Minnesota. We represent the residential construction industry. And I'm here respectfully to oppose the bill. Anna, you had a lengthy conversation already about those words in conflict with versus different from. I want to make this really easy. as representing the construction industry, Representative Eastland, you asked, you know, what does this really mean? Well, a municipality can require only brick siding if they want to, rather than aluminum siding, with no standard. So basically what a city can say is, well, gee, we only want people in our community building houses that can afford brick siding rather than aluminum siding. So there is a reason why we give the Department of Labor and Industry this issue of uniformity. Safety clearly is one of the reasons, and economic is a second reason. So I think we need to be very cautious about how we address these words. We are very supportive of the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision on their making a bright line between what the building code does and does not do. I empathize with the cities that it does take away some of the authority they have. Representative Kalin asked earlier, well, gee, you know, is there really a patchwork of building codes in the state? Well, I'll tell you, a municipality has all kinds of ways to require things outside of the building code. Development agreements are one of them. You know, they've got a developer over the barrel. If they want certain items in a new subdivision. So respectfully, I would say that we want to work with the partners. We've worked all summer with you. You know, I don't understand why a municipality can't just adopt the International Property Maintenance Code. I know many municipalities in the state already have. It works in tandem with the International Residential Code, which is what the residential construction industry works under. These documents were designed to work with each other. The Property Maintenance Code explains what the building code does in residential terms, so it does not prohibit a municipality from not taking care of safety issues. I found it interesting some of the things that the individual testified from the city of Minneapolis, that they can't do things. Well, gosh, they can. And there are ways to get that done. So I think there is a lot of confusion amongst the partners. We certainly have had heated discussions about this. We want to find a solution. Obviously, we want cities to be able to maintain their properties and have their consumers maintain their properties. But there are a whole bunch of other tools that we're not considering, and maybe because we haven't had to agree with them, those tools. So I want to let you know that we're here to work to find some solutions. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Weaver. Any questions for the testifier? Okay. I've got Christine Berger on my list from the Realtors. Please state your name and for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Christine Berger, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And we are here today to respectfully oppose House File 2945. We agree with the previous testifiers that this bill does allow municipalities to exceed the state building code, and actually creates a large exemption from the code, and in a way that we feel is actually contrary to the code, because the code for us has always been there to provide uniformity and clarity across the state, and consistency across the state, to avoid patchwork. And so we also feel that this will, from a real estate perspective, also add significant costs to homeowners if they have to require, or if they'd be required to satisfy these higher new requirements that exceed the state code. And unfortunately right now, as we all know, a lot of homeowners are underwater and are unable to afford their current mortgage payments. And so a lot of homeowners that have maybe lost their jobs or can't afford their mortgage anymore are trying to sell their properties. So if they're trying to sell their properties and there's a point of sale inspection in the municipality, they may be unable to afford, since they can't afford their mortgage, they may be unable to afford the new higher requirements they may have to bring their house up to. We think the consequences of this is it opens the door to active replacements. And just to give you an idea, 30-60% of our marketplace right now consists of properties for sale that are either underwater or are heading towards foreclosure. So let me just give a hypothetical example that I just kind of thinking about. And it's just a hypothetical example, but say, for example, my house, under the code which it was built, required 3 inches of insulation. And the city would like to see 6 inches of insulation in the property. By striking different from and changing it to in conflict with, it's allowing cities to exceed the state building code because 6 inches of insulation is not in conflict with 3 inches of insulation. It's not in conflict. So it's allowed under this bill, but 6 inches is different from 3 inches, and so that would not be allowed under current law for the city to exceed the state code. So we really hope to keep the code uniform and to have it be a common, predictable standard. We think there's potentially areas of room for abuse and inconsistency between localities. And we also believe that there are already authorities under state statute and local ordinances that cities can address problem properties, nuisance properties, abandoned properties. And so we respectfully ask you to please oppose House File 2945. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Berger. Any questions for the witness? Any more witnesses that want to speak for or against? Come forward and state your name for the tape.
My name is Bill Barnhart. I'm here on behalf of the Northern Metropolitan Mayors Association. That's a grouping of cities, about 18 cities, and 2 counties on the north side of Twin Cities, and we're here to support the bill. I think oftentimes there's a tendency to think of older housing as something that resides in the center cities or the outstate regional centers. However, when you look at such places as Frisco, Robbinsdale, New Hope, Lower Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, Columbia Heights, Spring Lake Park, Mounds View, most of that housing was built in the late 40s, 50s, and 60s. To these cities, it is extremely important that they be able to deal proactively with the issues that are coming up, especially as the housing foreclosure crisis has been playing out. So within that context, this is another group of cities which are very supportive.
Thank you, Mr. Barnhart. Any questions for the witness? Representative Mahoney, you want to wrap up your bill and stand for questions?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this has been the code for a substantial length of time. If you look on page 2, line 33, it says, unless the ordinance conflicts with the provision in the state building code that regulates components or systems. Conflicts has been in the code, as a word in the code, for a very, very long time. So I don't know that conflict versus difference will be problematic in figuring out. I'm not sure how a city would be able to require 6 inches of insulation if the building code calls for just 3. That would be in conflict. And to Ms. Weaver's point, it sounds like people want to find a solution, and I think, and I'm hoping that we can find a solution, because we need conformity, we need consistency, not conformity. I hate conformity. Almost anyone knows. But we should have some consistency across the state in terms of what the college kid in St. Cloud is living in and the family in North York is living in. So I think this is a way to start it, and I would ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Any questions before we go to a vote? All those in favor of House File 2945, Representative Sterner renews his motion on House File 2945. Be recommended to be passed and returned to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Direction. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your members.
Hopefully you can continue working on it to try. Next bill we're going to take up is Representative Slocum's House File 2729. Welcome to the committee.
Representative Sterner moves that House File 2729 be recommended to pass and returned to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. Proceed, Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank you for hearing my bill. I think it'll be a lot easier than the last one you just heard. My bill is for Richfield and it's for firefighters. And my fire chief came to see me and he talked about layoffs and he talked about the cuts in government aid and he talked about public safety to me. And we're in a situation where we need to maintain our firefighting staff. What this bill does is just for the city of Richfield. I'm going to say that again, just for the city of Richfield. Is it initiates a requirement that a new hire firefighter must live within 10 minutes response time of the fire station. And initially I had quite a few questions about this. But the 10-minute response time gives 3 to 4 communities for a firefighter to live. It doesn't say you must live in Richfield, though that'd be nice. But it doesn't say that. It gives the firefighters a nice choice of communities to live in within 10 minutes of the station. And what convinced me, oh, the other thing is this bill has and that's only for the first 10 years of that firefighter's employment. So the new hires, only for the first 10 years of employment, 10-minute response time. And it would expire in 7 years, so there's a sunset. And the reason that this is important for my community is that it's going to save jobs. If you pass this bill, you will save firefighting jobs. My city has professional firefighters, and they would have to go to an on-call, correct me if I'm wrong, system, and we would lose some full-time firefighter jobs. And then I'm going to refer to my testimony.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. Can you please identify yourself for the tape and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brad Spam. I'm the Richfield Fire Chief. And as you're aware, current state statute prohibits cities within the 7-county metro area from establishing residency requirements for employment. It is allowed outstate. It's also allowed, though, for paid on call / volunteer firefighters. Cities within the metro area can establish times for those, but for full-time firefighters, in fact, any employee currently can. We've worked closely from a labor management perspective with our firefighter local union president, who is with me today, and also with the president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, who have always had a great interest in residency requirements. Several years ago, residency was allowed requirements. That was taken out via legislation. And so over that time, we have found it difficult because people choose to live further out, further away, not live as close to work. And so now we've lost our pool of firefighters while they're off duty, being close enough to respond back quickly. We're a small department, fully career department. On a daily basis, we handle 90% of our emergency events and runs with our on-duty staffing. So it's a minimal staffing, but they're able to handle it. However, 100 to 150 times a year, our on-duty staffing gets overwhelmed. Some events that cause that are structure fires. Multiple or simultaneous events. Our folks also respond to medical emergencies, which makes up a lot of them. So they do close to 3,500 to 4,000 runs a year. And also providing mutual aid support to our neighboring communities. Again, everyone uses mutual aid. It's a very effective way to leverage resources when you need them during those surge capacities. As I mentioned over the years, though, the number of our members living close has dwindled. They're living further and further out.
And having off-duty firefighters close by, living close by the station, so we can call them back off-duty in a reasonable amount of time, is leverages our capabilities of our minimal staff, getting well-trained, people that are used to working with each other back rapidly when we need to. It provides, I feel, a safe, effective, and economic way of delivering our emergency services. So this residency bill for you today would be a great tool to help us maintain our local service and utilize the folks more effectively when they're off duty, and basically use them when we have surge capacity versus staffing them there for every conceivable situation we might have.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Fear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Slocum, or one of the testifiers, the 10 minutes. 10 minutes during what time of the day in Richfield? I mean, that's a big spread if I come through there at 10 o'clock at night or 8 o'clock in the morning, and who gets to determine the 10 minutes?
Representative Beard, Mr. Chairman, the 10 minutes, we actually mapped out, and again, trying to answer your question there, I'm not sure there's an absolute answer when you're talking about traffic patterns during the day. We would probably at least start using a GIS mapping method, which will account for traffic flows, and probably would rely on that as kind of our baseline. There are probably a couple other ways. Something is simple, I'm not sure it's reliable, is using MapQuest, they have driving times. So I think we rely primarily on a GIS. Also, probably driving the anticipated or selected route several times throughout the day to get a feel. I'm sure there would, if this would come to pass, there would be times that, especially folks that were living close to that 10-minute driving time, may not make it in 10 minutes. And I think that's one of those things we have to accept and live with a little bit.
Representative Beard.
Excuse me. I'm noticing, thank you, Mr. Chair, it only applies to firefighters hired after the effective date. So this is for firefighters yet to come then, to be clear.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. That helps. Thanks.
Existing would not be impacted.
Okay. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to raise the question that Representative Beard did as well, but I have another. I'm sure that the intention here is that this would be applied uniformly, but the bill as it's written doesn't really say that. I mean, maybe this is a question for Ms. Dyson, but shouldn't this really read something like the City of Richfield may impose by rule or ordinance? The way it's written, it seems to me that it could just be applied arbitrarily. Doesn't say you have to do that uniformly, it just says you may do it.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I don't think it could be imposed sort of casually across the board. It's either going to be a resolution or an ordinance or a term of condition of employment that under the employment agreement site. So I'm not quite sure which one of those three, but I don't think it could be applied to an individual hire at a time. That would result in litigation.
State your name for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. I'm the president of the Richfield Local Firefighters Union. And within the state statute of 415, it does mention in there that even if the cities and the unit or muster three is, the city must have an ordinance that approves the resolutions. So it can't just be an agreement between us. It's got to go before the city also. That's how I understand your question was.
Yes, thank you.
That answer your question?
I think so.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got just a few kind of questions. How many of your current firefighter staff live in this prescribed area.
Chief Spam.
Representative Newsom, Mr. Chairman. I believe right now it is about four or five, including a couple of our chief officers. And we have a staff. We're authorized for 26 personnel, including chief officers. Right now, we're down to probably about 5 out of 24 at this point. And those numbers have been going down over the years.
Representative Eastland.
And how many, what's your turnover? I mean, how many people are you going to hire in the next 7 years? How's that going to change, you know, this ratio, I guess? Is there a big retirement hiring chunk coming on here that you're trying to address and hit this thing with?
Chief Spam.
Thank you. Yes. That is one, right? Currently, we have two openings or two positions that have not been filled. We've been waiting to see how budget will impact us. I'm looking at probably in the next couple of years, possibly even 1 to 3 years, at least 3 more eligible for retirement. So this would be a start towards building up those numbers for our off-duty response.
Representative Eastland.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I understand your point of view in trying, but I think of as people apply for jobs. I mean, what if somebody lives a little bit outside of this area? They own their house. They've gotten laid off. They want to get in a new occupation, and all of a sudden, a new occupation requires that they have to move. You know, I think there's some things that are almost kind of discriminatory here against people that may want to apply for some of those jobs. I mean, that's just a comment. I don't expect you to answer that. I understand what you're trying to do, and I'm just saying, is that a pitfall out there maybe? Then I guess the last question is, why the 7 years? Why does it expire in 7 years? Why aren't we doing this going forward and make me permanent?
Representative Eastland, Mr. Chairman, the 7 years, yes. And as we spent a lot of time, I'll say, negotiating this, because it was truly a labor management team effort, and also along with Representative Slocum, that because sometimes residency can be controversial, we thought we'll do essentially 10, what we call 10 minutes for 10 years, but put a, maybe for lack of a better term, a sunset or a revisit in 7 years to evaluate, see how it's going, does it need to be changed or adjusted, even though that was short of the lifespan of a new hire for that 10 years. So that was a chance for everybody to down the road and look at it and sit back and reinvestigate.
Just one last comment. The other question is if new hires are going to be living in this closer proximity, then new hires are going to be the ones that are called on for the emergency situations more than others. Is that kind of an assumed consequence or result of this, that they're gonna have a bigger responsibility when it comes to response time issues, that they're going to be the ones on call?
Chief Spelman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, that's probably correct to a certain extent. When we have large events, we recall all of our off-duty personnel. Granted, the ones that live quite a ways away may choose not to come in, which is, that they're prerogative. We're dealing with usually when we need to have people back in to backfill our stations or assist at the scene. It's that first 30 minutes of when we get overwhelmed is critical. So through the folks that live close are going to be put to work a little bit more, but everybody under our current policy has the opportunity when there's a recall to come back in.
Chief Spam, I think you said earlier that volunteer fire departments currently have this authority to be able to do this, and so you're just asking to have the same communities around you in the metro area that have volunteer fire departments, you're asking for the same authority to have this 10-minute or time limit like those. Chief Spam.
Yes, sir, that's correct. Some of the departments that are combination career and paid on call, that they are able to impose a
time restriction for how far they're paid on call folks live from the station. We don't utilize paid on call. I think to be able to recall our full-time members because they work daily in and out with each other. They're very well trained. I think it's also an effective way of using those personnel. And I think both methods are probably have good and bad points, but that's what we're asking for, yes.
Representative Viskins.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
I also have Tom Thornburg. Did you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Thornburg. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. And I just want to say that normally I'm not an advocate of residency requirements. I guess I'm not really viewing this as a residency requirement. It's more of a response time requirement. In the case of Richfield, I can support this because their small department, as Chief Swinner pointed out, they don't have any paid-on-call firefighters or volunteers in Richfield to help back up the full-time firefighters. So it is important that they have the ability to have people come back quickly. And I'd like to respond to Representative Eastland's comment about the newer people, the burden falling on them. That might not be a bad thing. If you're a new firefighter, your pay is obviously much smaller, and they would reap the benefit of the overtime if they're called in. So they may welcome that burden. So also, with the time requirement, I can support this because it will allow these firefighters to live in other communities outside of Richfield, South Minneapolis, Edina, Bloomington. So they would have more opportunities for different school districts if their kids would be in other school districts and so forth. And the local supports this, which is the important part for me as president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. And the trial period of 7 years. We, from the state association, will be watching this very closely, too, to make sure that this works. So, those are my comments, and I'll stand for any questions from the committee.
Any questions for the testifier? If not, anything else? Want to wrap up, Representative Slocum?
Just very briefly, I think this is a good bill and that it will save jobs.
With that, Representative Sterner renews his motion to recommend House File 2729 be to pass and be returned to the government. The Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on is Representative Hansen, House File 162.
And members of the committee, I will try to be brief. You'll notice that the House File 162 is a fairly low House File number, and there have been some things that have happened in the year, and I believe we have a packet, an A2 amendment that kind of acknowledges to remove the money from the general, and there also was some action in the tax bill that referenced the range stakeholders, and so we needed this to have something in statute to work with. So if I could have someone move the
We're starting with Representative Sterner moves House File 162 to be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on State and Local Government. Representative Sterner, you want to move the House File A62?
Sure, I'll move the House File A62.
All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion, amendment adopted. With that, it's in the condition you want it, so yes.
Thank you.
Explain your bill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, drainage has been an issue in Minnesota for many years, and about 5 years ago, we began a journey in the legislature trying to assess drainage and look at changes that can be made trying to bring the drainage law into the 21st century. A drainage work group was established and over the last few years has developed consensus recommendations. The bill in front of you, as amended, is really the consensus recommendations from 2008. We have a very diverse work group, everyone from the Farm Bureau to the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, Fish and Wildlife Alliance, folks who get together and talk drainage law, which is not that exciting, but very important and affects a lot of landowners. And so the local government provisions in here, you will see a lot of changes that bring the statute into kind of current nomenclature, current law, and also bringing up some of the financial amounts. You'll notice there's a provision where it references essentially a reimbursement of 30-cent stamps. I don't know how long ago it was that stamps were 30 cents, but we changed that to say that the costs that are involved in providing notification. I have with me Al Kane from the Board of Water and Soil Resources, plus I know there are members from the drainage work group here, and Mr. Kane could maybe talk in summary a little bit about the bill.
Mr. Kane, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Al Kane. I serve as the Chief Engineer for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And I also serve as a facilitator for the Stakeholder Drainage Work Group. It is a group of volunteers who have come together, as Representative Hansen indicated, for the past several years to discuss many drainage issues, including drainage law. Also in your packet, you will see a handout, a fact sheet about the drainage work group. It does list all of the different organizations and entities who are represented on the work group. And as Representative Hansen indicated, a number of those members are here in the audience today as well. The things that I'll point out for you today that I think are important to recognize, the two of the important pieces of drainage law that this bill addresses, 103E227, which is often referred to as the impoundment section. One of the things that we've encountered in conservation practices in recent years, particularly wetland restorations, that type of an impoundment, the provision really didn't envision a drainage system reroute, and that oftentimes is an appropriate way to restore a wetland on a public drainage system. So this modifications, revisions would enable a reroute to be recognized, understood, if you will. And then also it provides provision in there for partnership between conservation programs and drainage systems for those types of projects. So again, it's revising, clarifying, and providing more opportunity for multi-purpose partnership types of projects. Another provision in drainage law that is used quite frequently for wetland restorations, other types of impoundment projects, is 103E805. It's the removal and partial abandonment of a drainage system. And as the title indicates, functions. One is removal of land from a drainage system. The other is partial abandonment of a drainage system. The way that that provision was previously written has created some confusion because of the mix, if you will, of the two functions, and the way that it was explained in the process was not real clear. So what the Drainage Work Group has done is come up with recommendations for revising 103805 and separating the two functions. So 805 would remain as the removal function, and the new recommended 103E806 would be the partial abandonment function. And they both keep the same criteria as was previously in law, but they clarify how to do that. They also include more clarity on notification of landowners within the drainage system. And one of the provisions that was added last year, an amendment to include clarity around newspaper notice and website notice. and we were able to discuss that and work with Senator Frederickson, who was a proponent of that amendment, and clarify that the newspaper and website would be an or, so that there would be two forms of notification. One required, which is mail, and the other, which is optional, is either website notice or newspaper notice. So three potential ways that drainage authorities could notify: one required, the other two optional. And trying to move again, if you will, into the future of website notices being a way to do that. Another provision that was added with Representative Hansen's amendment is to provide some clarity around the Board of Water and Soil Resources function to coordinate drainage stakeholders. There previously had not been anything in statute regarding this function. It was one that was born again out of a study that became then a voluntary work group. And the recommendation out of the work group is to add some language under 103B101, which are the key functions and authorities of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. This language would clarify and put in statute a function for Bowser to coordinate drainage stakeholder working together.
Now, I see there was an appropriation here in the previous bill, and we moved it by the amendment. Is the cost of this going to be borne by the existing committees, or is there no cost to the bill?
There's no cost. There's no cost.
Thank you. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see we're putting in this new group. Who is the drainage authority, I guess, is my question. I mean, we're kind of taking out board and kind of the traditional language that we're used to. Who is the drainage authority that we're talking about here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, drainage authorities are defined in Chapter 103E, which is the drainage law, as being counties and watershed districts. So they are the public drainage authorities for Chapter 103E.
Thank you, Mr. King.
And just one other question. I guess, I'm all in favor of the website notification process. I'm just wondering how many people make a practice of looking at the drainage authority's website. To me, that's like kind of just putting it out someplace in space there. It's not something that people typically look at, read, go to, or whatever, and I'm a little concerned about that, quite frankly.
Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it is part of the discussion that the work group has had in that regard. Recognize again that the 103.805 and 806 provisions require a mailed notice to all property owners within it, so that the newspaper or the web was primarily trying to reach others who might have some interest in those proceedings, but clearly the property owners are covered.
Any other questions for the testifier? Anybody else wish to speak for or against the bill?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to, I think that the work group is in support of this, and maybe in the interest of time, I think they could nod their heads if they are, if there's anybody here.
I see a lot of heads back there not nodding.
It is a broad-based group, and they are supporting.
And with this, is anybody opposed to this bill who would like to speak against it or not? With that, Representative Stirner renews his motion that House File 162 be recommended to pass as amended and be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, sir. Next we have, I'm going to just jump another one here, Representative Peterson. Is she still in the room?
Get the matches.
And I apologize to Representative Gardner, but there's a thing going on tonight that Representative Peterson has to get to, so. Welcome to the committee. With that, Representative Sterner moves that House File 2309 be recommended to pass and return to the committee on state and local government. With that, proceed with your bill and introduce your testifiers.
And thank you for putting me ahead of Representative Gardner. I really do appreciate that. And I would also point out that this bill has passed unanimously in the Senate, and that's why you have the rest of Peterson, I assume, and the Senate file listed on the agenda. But I'm very pleased to be here, Mr. Chair, and this is an important piece of legislation for my community of New Hope. And we're pretty unique in terms of this piece of legislation, we in East Grand Forks. And so this relates to local government, and it talks about the probationary period for newly hired peace officers in certain statutory cities. And with that, we're going to get into details. It should be a very brief testimony, but this is Chief Link, and he is from New Hope, and I turn it over to him. And by the way, my other testifier is Rich Johnson, who is the Human Resources Manager.
Please state your name for the tape, and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you. Gary Link, Chief of Police for New Hope. As Representative Peterson stated, New Hope and East Grand Forks are very unique. Every other law enforcement agency in the state hires peace officers under a 12-month probationary period. We're unique because both of our communities have adopted Chapter 44 a very long time ago. And in order to extend the probationary period to 12 months for our new hires, we're before the legislature here requesting this change. Last year, we had an incident where a newly hired officer experienced an extended medical leave issue. By the time we were able to get him back to work, there was insufficient time to complete the field training officer program, which is generally 13 weeks, followed by a 13-week evaluation under the current 6-month probationary period. For that reason, I had to let him go, and that is the reason that I've been working to have this change before you today. There is no conflict with the proposal in front of you. Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, both the Supervisory Union and the Police Officers Union at New Hope support this legislation. And in contact with Chief Mike Hedlund of East Grand Forks, he has received the same support from his community and his employees there. And I'll end my testimony there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And do you want any questions for the testifiers? With that, any closing remarks or?
No, I think it's a needed piece of legislation for these two cities to put them in conformity with the rest of the state. I think it's a good piece of legislation. I would recommend its passage.
With that, Representative Sterner renews his motion that Senate File 2309 be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on State and Local Government. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
And with that, the next bill is Representative Gardner, House File 418. And I apologize again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sterner moves House File 418 to be passed and recommended to pass and be referred to the State Local Government Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 418 is a bill that would set up would be permissive in allowing municipalities to create an ordinance to control evacuated buckthorn. I originally had another bill that was considerably more stringent, where we just say, let's make buckthorn a noxious weed, and that set off alarm bells all over the place, because that would have essentially required local governments everywhere to try and get rid of it. and had a significant cost. So we chose this option last year and passed the Agriculture Committee that would, it's just permissive and would allow a municipality to adopt an ordinance if they want to. I have, as a test card, Joan Brainard, who's a longtime resident of North Oaks in my district, who has been on the front lines of dealing with Buckthorn.
And before we do that, I see you have an amendment here, the A1 amendment. Is that yours?
I beg your pardon. I don't actually have an amendment, but Ms. Dyson, I don't know how yours could look.
It's the Sam Malone glasses.
We do have an amendment that changes that. But I don't have it.
Representative Sterner moves House File, or the amendment, the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment to put the bill in the form that the representative wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's adopted. And with that, Ms. Brainard, I was looking at the name there.
My name is Joan Brainard, and I'm resident of North Oaks. And I work the wellness arm on trying to get Buckthorn. For years and years, over 40 years, I've had a very successful Oakville control program that has maintained our native species. And then somebody came in the back door and dropped some buckthorn seeds. And now we're losing our native species, and we have no way of really controlling the buckthorn. We've done an educational program, and many of our residents, but I know we have voluntarily removed the buckthorn. However, buckthorn is spread by birds who eat the seeds and the berries from buckthorn. Then they drop, fly around, drop the seeds and their feces onto property that has been cleared of buckthorn. So there's an injustice in my mind to those people who go through the process of removing the buckthorn. And this legislation is enabling a city to adopt an ordinance that does not require any city, unless they wish to do so, to adopt an ordinance. And they can make their own requirements in the ordinance. Generally speaking, other municipalities that have done this elsewhere usually put a time period like 5 years it must be removed, or it must be removed at the time of sale. And whether North Oaks could do that or not, I do not know, but we cannot do anything about controlling buckthorn without enabling legislation at the state statute level. Otherwise, it would be something to support.
Any questions for the testifier or the representative? Anybody that wishes to speak against the amendment or the bill?
I believe the powerful buckthorn preservation lobby is.
They're all planting buckthorn, okay.
Mr. Chair, the trademark question has been cleared that there's now clear, I believe NWA is now registering as lobbyists, the Noxious Weed Association, and I don't think they've chimed in on the bill yet, but I hope they'll have some time to do so.
But it's not an option.
With that, Representative Sterner renews his motion that House File 162, be, as amended, be recommended to pass and return to the State and Local Government Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Why don't we give Representative Atkins?
I think Representative Hilty has some folks here from Greater Minnesota. Okay. So you may
Representative Hilty. And Representative Hilty, do you want to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair, move that House File 2797 be recommended to pass and be referred to the committee and local government, etc.
And I see you have an amendment, the A1 amendment?
I do. Mr. Chair, I think the bill is sufficiently simple that it would be appropriate to just move the amendment to get the bill in. But I would like to have it considered in the condition in which it passed the Senate earlier today. So I would move the A1 amendment, which adds an additional four words to the four-word original bill. The amendment was brought to me by Mr. Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society, which is kind of discovering that they have the same situation that we find with the Indian tribes and not actually being recognized in the statute as it currently exists.
All those in favor of the amendment, the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order, say aye.
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 Opposed? Moving. The amendment passes. Subscribe your bill, and what does it do? And you can ask questions.
Well, Mr. Chair, as amended, it adds two entities to the statute defining joint powers agreements and who's eligible to enter into the joint powers. The members that read the bill, the statute is quite comprehensive, and the entities that are already included in that. And I was quite surprised when this bill was brought to me initially to realize that Indian tribes were not among those entities described in statute. But certainly, I think in a time when innovation and cooperation and joint efforts are perhaps more needed than ever, it certainly makes sense to make it possible for tribes to be able to enter into those agreements in the communities in which they exist and across the state. If the committee is interested, I have with me at the table Mr. Tad Johnson, who I believe is, I think I have your title correct, as the general counsel for the Nawaxa Band of the Ojibwe, who can describe to the committee the actual situation that gave rise to this proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Tad Johnson. I'm special counsel on government affairs for the Nawaxa Band. Here today to lend support to House File 2797, which will update Minnesota Statute 471.59, the state law that defines the governments that may enter into joint powers agreements. As you look at the statutes, you see a detailed listing of all the local governments that fall under the definition of governmental unit, according to the statute, as well as a reference to state and federal agencies. The one category of government that is not listed is tribal governments. Considering the statute goes back to 1943, it's not surprising that tribal governments are not listed. Entering into joint powers agreements with tribes was not thought of until more recently. Tribes are now in the position to help develop cooperative and cost-effective solutions to health care, education, transportation, emergency management, emergency response, and economic development challenges that are along with local governments in the state of Minnesota. Tribes currently do this through self-governance compacts with the federal government and through agreements with the state under some state statutes regarding gaming compacts and law enforcement. And now we simply want to add federally recognized Indian tribes to this statute. It's a simple language change, and the terminology is commonplace in federal Indian law and other state statutes. This change will give the Mille Lacs Band and other tribes in Minnesota the same voting authority and representation that other governments already have if they choose to participate in cooperative agreements. This change has the support of the Association of Minnesota Counties and the League of Minnesota Cities, whose members are obvious partners for Indian tribes in these endeavors. Other Indian tribes are supportive of this, and specifically, right now, the Mille Lacs Band is a member of the NLX Alliance. We're an ex officio member, which is the train group that is supporting the train running from the Twin Cities up to Duluth. Part of that goes through tribal land. We wanted to be part of the group. They allowed us to join the NLX Alliance and accepted our dues of $48,000. However, we soon discovered we couldn't vote until this statutory change. But we've discovered a lot of tribes have come forward and talked to us over the last several weeks about all the different things, types of agreements they could enter into, and everything from barbers on reservations, for example, are not allowed to, the hours they spend cutting hair on the reservation is not recognized by the state for the purposes of licensing barbers. And we talked to the AG's office, and they said if you can amend this statute, you can fix that. Emergency response, I serve on the Tribal Emergency Response Committee. We could enter into agreements with counties for ambulance, other services. And so there's a lot of different things we could do with this language. And so my lifespan fully supports it, and from what I've heard, all the tribes support it. I don't know if anybody opposes it.
Thank you, Mr. Any questions for the testifier? I see somebody from the Historical Society. Do you want to speak for what?
Or against?
With that, no questions. Representative Hilty renews his motion that it be recommended to pass as amended and returned to the Committee on State and Local Government. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And last, Representative Atkins.
I'm wondering the same thing.
Representative Sterner moves House File 3017. He recommended to pass and re-referred to the Local Government Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
State and Local Government Committee.
In light of the time of the last item on your agenda, I'll try to be fairly brief. This is the Fill the Boot Bill.
Mm-hmm.
The cities across the country have been doing these campaigns on their firefighters. 20 cities across Minnesota as well have been working with Muscular Dystrophy Association since 2006 to raise money to fight muscular dystrophy. Of late, in the two cities, Minneapolis and Duluth, have expressed some reservations, not about the cause, but just about the fact that there's not expressed legislative authority to do it, and some insurance questions. So this bill addresses those questions, which provides for the insurance. I met earlier today with some of the insurance folks, and I think there's a minor tweak that they want to have take place when we get to the Commerce Committee with it. But in essence, what it allows for a city to, and it's permissive to cities, they're not required to do this. But it says they're allowed to let their firefighters do this for one organization a year, up to 3 days. The charitable organization has to provide proof of liability insurance. We think that addresses the issues. With that, I've got Mr. Thornburg from the Professional Firefighters and some folks from MDA as well that are here to provide whatever testimony or answer any questions that you may have about the bill.
Any questions from above testifier about the bill? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I think it's a simple but important thing to do to make sure that that our other folks who serve can help important organizations. I do have one concern that I hope that you can assuage for me, that I did spend a year in Massachusetts, and the Fill the Boot campaigns are really successful there and very visible. I hope that this doesn't represent a slide into other areas of Massachusetts practices, like having 17 troopers sit around and guard two people working on the road, and just appreciate if you can make sure that we're not going down that road. That'd be very helpful.
Thank you. I will assage that. We don't intend to.
Representative Stern.
Well, I just was wondering if you would want to fix the insurance thing now before it goes to Commerce, or do you want to wait on Commerce? Because we'll see just a couple words that would get in the right form.
Chair.
Representative Atkins.
Well, I have some reservations about that Commerce Committee chair.
Okay. Yeah.
It's my understanding that the Insurance Federation and the agent have slightly different language.
Okay.
And both of which accomplish the same thing, and I think we're on the same page. It's just it'll allow for a written amendment rather than an oral one. If this committee's comfortable with that, and that's within the purview of the Congress Committee to handle the insurance stuff. So I think that's probably what we're
talking about. I think Ms. Dyson would prefer that too.
Mr. Chair.
She usually does.
Representative,
I think Representative Pulaski would prefer that.
Representative Lanning, did you put your hand?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins,
wondering about whether or not a city with this language would be able to put forward some stipulations or restrictions to make sure it's a safe situation. We've had concerns in our community about the safety of that solicitation. And is it possible, would it be possible with this language for a city council to make some stipulations in terms of making sure it's a safe solicitation, that motorists are not, pedestrians are not put in harm's way?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, notwithstanding what Ms. Eisen may add to the equation, I don't believe that this language is preemptive. It would allow for the provisions within the statute that the crime passed, but to the extent that a city would like to go beyond those requirements, I believe it fully allows them to do so. Moreover, obviously, we're concerned about the safety side of it, too, or we wouldn't be talking about the insurance requirement that we are. So I think it's a very sound concern, and I don't believe anything here would prevent a city from going further with respect to working with their firefighters to make sure that everybody's safe.
Representative Lanning.
Yeah, well, thank you. Since we have conditions here and that one wasn't mentioned, that's why I wanted to make sure that you're not in any way restricting cities from doing that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, I think to the extent that we start to prescribe certain items, then it would almost be more limiting than if we were to leave that open to cities to work with your firefighters to talk about what sort of safety measures they want to have taken when they engage in the fill the boot campaigns.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, I'm just noticing the words to solicit charitable contributions from motorists. And I'm thinking about this guy who just irritates the daylights out of me that stands on the corner of Kellogg and 35E every morning. Please tell me this isn't what you have in mind. I'm not familiar with how these things work, but I can just see a firefighter with a cardboard sign and a boot standing there staring people down at the red light. Is this what happens, or?
Representative Atkins.
Chairman, Representative Beard. We've actually got him lined up.
Well, he's pretty darn good at it.
You know what? I haven't done it personally, but I think what we might want to do is take a little testimony from these folks who have frontline experience with respect to how it occurs. Who better, by the way, than firefighters to know how to remain safe.
Okay.
And I think that's probably part of the reason why these two organizations have come together. Is if you are going to solicit from motorists using the fill, I see you've got boots on it. We obviously want it to occur in a safe fashion. And if anybody would know about safety, I would think it'd be firefighters. But with that, Mr. Chairman,
please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Thornburg. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. Just to give you a little background on firefighters filling the boot for Muscogee District Association. The International Association of Firefighters, who is our parent organization, we've been doing this in cities across the United States and Canada since 1955. It's fairly new to Minnesota. We've been doing it for 3 years in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and it's growing. We've brought as I said, firefighters doing similar things, but not on duty on the street, fill the boot in Minnesota. We've been doing around the stadiums and so forth for quite a long time. Since we've been doing on the street, on duty, fill the boot, our numbers have gone from about collecting $30,000 a year to about $300,000 a year. So it's a huge difference, and it makes a huge difference, as you'll hear from the other testifiers when they get a chance to talk. But to answer your question, we're not going to be irritating for all year. It's restricted to 3 days per year. And the 3 days is because typically full-time firefighters work three shifts. So it gives each shift a chance to do this. Representative Atkins said, it is permissive. Each city gets to decide whether or not they want to allow their firefighters to do this. The reason we're bringing this for is because in Duluth and Minneapolis, I guess, in lack of better words, they were looking for some cover from the state to say that it's okay to say it's okay. And so that's why we brought this forward. I'll let the other testifiers, I have representative from Muscular Dystrophy Association, Karen Abrahamson. I'll stand for any questions that you may have, otherwise I'll turn over to the other testifiers.
Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Abrahamson, and I work for the Muscular Dystrophy Association. I just wanted to provide you more so just some facts about the organization. And MDA and the International Association of Firefighters have been partnered together for over 55 years with this program, and they've been largely supportive of Tom and his groups around the state. Some of just the facts that you may or may not know about MDA. We were founded in 1950. We have over 200 offices throughout the country. Three of them reside here in Minnesota, one in Duluth, one in Minneapolis, one in St. Paul. When it comes to some of the funding and why the Feel the Good Initiative is so important to us and the work that our firefighters do with us is what it helps with us as an organization. All the money that we raise in Minnesota stays local to Minnesota. And some of the things of how that's translated in a year-by-year basis is in some of the services that we provide as an organization is research. And in the last 18 months, we've funded about $1.7 million worth of research here in Minnesota based on researchers that have requested money from us. And over the course of the last 5 years, that has been about $3.2 million that we fund in the state. Some of the services and things that we provide include our support groups. We have a clinic network here in Minnesota with a clinic at SMDC in Duluth, as well as Gillette Jones here in St. Paul and the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. We see when the patients go there to see their doctor, we help cover as a third party pay to their insurance so that they can see a clinician as needed. And some of the other services that we provide is our summer camp program, which we pay completely free for a child from the age of 6 to 17 to 18, as well as some support groups. We also cover flu shots. In essence, in 2009, we spent about $400,000 on those services, like our clinics and camps and things like that. And then just over the last 5 years, kind of in summary of our support, we've funded about $7.2 million into the state. Of that, in 2009, was about $2.54 million, of which we actually generated and fundraised $1.9 million. So MDA actually spent an additional $607,000 in the state for various services to provide some of those researchers the cost and things like that. So that's why we're in support of our firefighters being out there collecting funds for MDA or any chosen charities.
Thank you. Identify yourself for the tape and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lynn Tibbetts, and I am one of the families that MDA and the firefighters support in their efforts. My son was diagnosed at his three-year-old checkup with muscular dystrophy. He is now 15, and instead of becoming a more independent, strong teenager, he becomes weaker and more dependent each day. This year, he will be the Minnesota State's Goodwill Ambassador. If you would have told me 5 years ago that this was going to happen, I would have told you not in a million years. That is when he lost his ability to walk. In losing his ability to walk, he lost who he was. And as a parent, I had a child that I couldn't make better. And really getting up and out of bed each day was a hard, hard task. But then I found MDA, I got involved with the firefighters and what they do. My son got involved, and through going through camp and working with the firefighters, he saw that even without legs, he could become a success. He could contribute. There are things that he could do. And in his application this year to become a Goodwill Ambassador, he said his biggest thing was just to show people that he could be out there next to a firefighter, he could be there raising money so that a cure could be found. And we know that the cure is very close. Right here at the University of Minnesota, such good work is being done. It's what gets me up each day and what makes me make a normal life for my son as much as possible. I hear the concerns, and they're legitimate. And I've been out there with the firefighters, and they are within traffic, and they are safe, and they're showing people how to be safe. They wait. But more importantly, I think it's inspiring to us who need this help, that our firefighters will serve their community in so many ways. It's inspiring to those who are donating money into that booth that their firefighters not only keep them safe, but they're out there helping so many. And I think it's inspiring to our firefighters. They see so many in our community supporting us, supporting them. And I think it goes beyond what their job is. And I'm so grateful that we have firefighters that on their downtime, that they would take their time and do something like this, like go into traffic in a safe manner and to contribute even more so to their community. So I hope you guys can come together and pass this bill. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any questions for the testifiers? I've got Brian Rice on my list here. Did Brian shake his head back there? So with that, Charlie, want to wrap it up, Representative Atkins? Or?
I don't want to say anything.
Okay. Representative Sturgeon renews his motion then to renew House File 3017 to be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative Sterner, would you like to move the minutes?
Sure. I'll move the minutes from last meeting. It looked wonderfully done. On set, so.
With that, all in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, we're adjourned.